Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. Time to look at some stories from some other parts of the world. News Talk's international correspondent Shona Murray joins us once again. Afternoon, Shona.
Afternoon, Sean.
Now, Peru is the first place we're going to. Now, this is a story about a young girl dying from a snake bite, but the circumstances that led to that are far more sinister.
Yeah, really awful. This is in the rural part of western Nepal in the Dalik district. 18-year-old girl, she died of a snake bite, but the reason why she was isolated is because she was banished to a shed, because tradition holds in that area that women have to spend every month while they're menstruating in a shed, isolated from the rest of the community. It's something that's actually banned in Nepal, but because it's a social practice, people still engage in it. So under this tradition, women are banned from taking part in any normal family activities during menstruation, or actually even after childbirth. They can have no contact with the men of the household. They're not allowed to touch animals, cattle. They're not allowed to touch their men. They're not allowed to use any of the facilities in the area. They're also banished in these little huts, and they're not allowed to cook. They're not allowed to be brought food, so they can't do anything nutritious. And often wild animals get them, which is obviously what happened here with the snake. And also when she was found, which is after 7 hours after the snake had bitten her, she was taken to a local shaman instead of a hospital. So that obviously exacerbated things, probably. But this is something that's quite common, not just in Nepal, but parts of India as well. It's just a local tradition. Again, it's banned in most places, but men in the village believe menstrual blood is poisonous, and that if they touch their wives while they're menstruating, they can become seriously ill. And then some women that breach that, who may inadvertently touch off an animal, if there's a crop failure, even years later, often that woman is blamed for that crop failure, which is an interesting thing because of the fact that it's all it's not legislated for anymore. In fact, it's outlawed. It's the same as sort of the FGM stuff. If you look at countries like Egypt, practices like FGM are banned since 2008 there, but 97% of women have had female genital mutilation, because the point is that you can impose national laws and international laws and Western standards, but if it's something that's culturally appropriate, then that's much more important for local communities. So even though you could have laws that say anybody sending these women off to the huts, they can spend time in prison, or they can be prosecuted in some way, what you need to do is actually just educate people and say, look, these women aren't dangerous because they're menstruating. In fact, if they were men, maybe they'd be championed for bleeding for, several days, a month, and giving birth to children. So it's really about education rather than prosecuting people.
Well, I mean, are you saying that in the FGM case that it's... You can introduce a law banning it, but enforcing that law is much more tricky.
It's the same with the women here in Nepal too. It's illegal to send these women off to those huts every month, but people are firmly believe that socially these women are dangerous to be around while they're menstruating, it doesn't matter what the laws are. And the same with the FGM situation. People can, any doctors or anybody caught bringing a child to be genitally mutilated can be in prison for 2 years. But that doesn't stop people, because they believe what's more important is a woman's virtue, and that's what they see FGM for.
Right, Colombia we're going to now, and I suppose some of the final steps in terms of the peace process and FARC.
So the President Santos gave his final amnesty decree, which basically gave 7,000 rebels in total amnesty for their crimes in the sort of FARC group, the FARC war, FARC civil war over the last 50 years. 7,000 is actually a big number, because at its height, FARC was only a group of 20,000 people, which is actually a very low number if you think of the potency of the FARC war. The amount of havoc and violence they wreaked upon the Colombian people. Colombia is a country of 48 million people. So essentially, this is quite controversial, because people probably remember that at the end of last year, there was a referendum in Colombia to decide whether or not to forge ahead with this peace process, and it was voted again down by 50.2%. And the reason why was because people believed that the FARC guerrilla, the members, were getting away too easily, and it was because of amnesties like this. So they've sort of altered it a bit, that anybody that can get an amnesty, they will be pardoned for their crimes, but it doesn't involve crimes like crimes against humanity, rape, kidnapping, violence, and torture. And I mean, I visited Colombia a couple of times, and one time was in the early 2000s, at the height of the sort of war between the FARC and these paramilitary groups that were sent in by some members of the government and others to target them. And the level of sexual violence was incredible. So it's a really controversial issue. But the point is, Colombians have had 50 years. This is the longest running war in the world. And out of the 50 years, 8 million people have been displaced. And that's probably around the same number of the people who have been displaced in Syria. Mm-hmm. 240,000 people have been killed. And then hundreds of thousands of people have probably been killed, but they're called the disappeared. So they're not even in that number. So it is an incredibly ambitious peace process. 50 years of war and incredible violence. So part of the process as well is because you have so many people involved in crimes against humanity, it's not possible to try them all, prosecute them all and send them to prison. So that's kind of why with these peace processes, amnesties have to exist, unfortunately, even though, you know, we may or may not like them. So what you have is the FARC has agreed to give up a lot of the money it's earned through the drug trade, because it was huge in the drug trade, as we know, in the 80s and 90s. Also, instead of going to prison, some people will be involved in the cleaning up of mines, because they displaced hundreds of thousands of people in order to allow the coca crop to grow. So they mined a lot of it so people couldn't get access to it. So they'll be cleaning up that. So it's part of the transitional process that you have reparations made to the communities and that you have the members of FARC not doing prison time always, but doing other ways of, you know, bringing back, I suppose, bringing something back or apologising to the nation. But it'll take decades before anything like this is really, you know, really sorted out. I mean, even in our own peace process, which is nowhere near the size, and we still, you know, it's been 20 years almost, yeah, and we still have those problems. And then actually, that's the other thing about this amnesty issue. As, you know, people don't trust these FARC guys who've been in basically terrorists for the last number of decades. What makes anyone believe that they're going to suddenly turn to being pillars of society when all they know is crime
actually,
and violence?
I was reading that a lot of them, like the lower down ones, because I understand there's some members of FARC whose parents were in FARC and they were sent off to get an education, then brought into the jungle again. And now these are perhaps young men and young women in their early 20s. But they can't apply for a job because what have you been doing for the last 5 years?
Exactly, you're going to be shunned. Another interesting thing about the FARC is the way they treated them, the women there as well. I mean, again, sexual violence was huge amongst the civilian population. I mean, as in they imposed sexual violence. But in the FARC, any woman that was found to be pregnant, and she was immediately sent for an abortion. Because, they needed their women as much as their men to be members of militants and not to be, you know, creating families. The families would have been local families that they forced or lured to become members of FARC, not people that they sort of grew within.
That's so interesting. We'll skip over the UK and go to Iraq
then.
And the battle around Mosul. Now, if Amnesty says that the anti-IS forces uses excessive firepower in places as devastated as Mosul, how do you even rate what excessive firepower is?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one because the Amnesty is talking about both sides, both parties to the hostilities. First of all, criticising, the Islamic State for, you know, hanging bodies and people from electricity pylons and using civilians as human shields. I mean, the barbarism we know from the Islamic State just knows no bounds. And then Amnesty is also talking about the engagement by the Iraqi forces, which used excessive force and indiscriminate force, because, you know, in Western Mosul, which was the last place to fall from the Islamic State, there were many civilians being held as human shields. And under the Geneva Conventions, under the laws of war, in fact, the whole basis of the Geneva Conventions is to prevent or to have the fewest number of civilian casualties as possible. Every army's responsibility is, of course, collateral damage happens, but you have a responsibility to make sure as little as possible. And that doesn't appear to be the case because a lot of the attacks were indiscriminate. Now, at the same time, what was happening was that you had the Islamic State burning crude oil in the areas that it still occupied in order to disrupt the missiles, the sort of precision-guided missiles coming from the air. So they ended up killing people inadvertently. And as well, what I'd say is that it was a ground fight too. So you had a lot of the army coming in with, you know, in their tanks, but they couldn't get much further because the place was so badly booby-trapped. So a lot of the soldiers, you had to just walk in and weave in and outside the alleyways. And it was a lot of face-to-face combat. And then civilians got very badly hurt in the spray, unfortunately. It was such a close combat. And then you also had, unfortunately, we saw this last week towards the dying days, was that women were sent out with suicide vests under their niqabs. And they detonated at the sort of screening areas. So you probably had Iraqi soldiers, not that I'm defending them, killing women that they thought were possible suicide bombers.
That would have made them nervous.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And that would make anyone nervous, given the ferocious nature of that fight.
Yeah, and because it seemed just particularly messy because it was street by street.
Yeah, it was really just old-fashioned combat, exactly, except for the fact that you had booby traps. They were IEDs blowing up at every sort of hand's turn.
Right, OK, El Salvador we're going to now. And yeah. A rape victim given a 30-year sentence.
Yeah, it's really, this is one of the most horrifying stories ever. Well, El Salvador is one of the countries in the world, there's five, that has abortion completely outlawed, regardless of any situation, regardless of the life of the mother. So, and this is a young girl who was routinely raped, and in April 2016 was in her third trimester and was having a miscarriage in the toilet. And she was bleeding, and her mother found her, brought her to a hospital in San Salvador, and immediately she was arrested, because this is what happens to women who have miscarriages. It's assumed that they haven't taken enough antenatal care while they're pregnant, whether they knew they were pregnant or not, and that the assumption is that they wanted to have a miscarriage. So it's kind of a form of an abortion. And then any women who have abortions, again, are given, you know, life imprisonment. So she was given 30 years, a 19-year-old girl, regardless of the fact that she'd been gang raped for several, a year or so beforehand. Her mother was also arrested because she had brought her into the hospital. She was handcuffed to her hospital bed for that whole period. And the prosecution said, use that case, saying that she didn't give enough antenatal care. And then the female judge agreed with that, female judge, and served her 30-year prison sentence, a 19-year-old girl. So it's really one of the most astonishing cases ever. Abortion was outlawed in El Salvador 20 years ago. And I think it was a referendum, but it was very closely supported by extreme sort of Catholic groups. And Amnesty International did a whole campaign about this about 2 years ago. And they found that only 70% of people wanted abortion outlawed, but only in the case of a woman's life being in danger, not, you know, rape or incest or any of those issues. They actually covered Ireland as part of this, but really, her lawyers have said that they are going to try to, you know, call for a retrial or repeal the sentence, but there will be a long, long road. There, actually, what happens in El Salvador as well is you have 20,000 women a year do engage in backstreet abortions, and around 11% of them die. So it's a whole thing about whether you can outlaw abortion and it'll still happen, and what you're doing is just killing women.
Shona, thanks a million for coming into us today. Shona Murray there. Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.